Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you each Saturday on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. We're going to hear a fascinating story today from a prisoner of war in the European theater during World War II, and it's a very timely guest, Mac McMullen, today, because a week from today, next Saturday, at the VA Hospital, Central California, which, of course, is in Fresno, there will be a dedication of the American Ex-Prisoner of War Monument. It's a very special day for those who were prisoners of enemy forces during World War II and other conflicts. A very special day next Saturday. It'll be at 10 a.m. at the VA Central California Hospital. That is on 2615 East Clinton Avenue, 10 a.m. next Saturday, April 10th, for the dedication of the American Ex-POW Monument. They would love to see you there. And if you're there, you can shake the hand of our guest today. Mac McMullen just turned 88 years old, and there were some days in 1945 that he didn't know if he was going to turn 30 or 40, because things were pretty hairy as a prisoner of the German forces during World War II. Let's start before that, though, Mac, if we can. Long before you became a prisoner, you were just an everyday citizen like everybody else in the country. How did you hear about the events of December 7th, 1941? I know you were growing up in Pittsburgh. What do you remember about that day and how you heard that the Japanese had attacked?
I had been to a matinee and a movie, and it came out, and, of course, everybody was talking about it. We didn't have any idea, of course, anything was happening, and right away we're all going to go down and join up. And in fact, I did 2 days later go down and try and join up, and I forget, they found something wrong with me, not serious, but they had their choice at that time.
So you're just 19 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And it's probably cold and snowy in Pittsburgh, right, in December?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
But 2 days later, you went to enlist.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? What made you want to go do that?
You had a different atmosphere then than you do now. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we found out we were at war, why, we were, hey, let's go get them, and rah, 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 and all this baloney. And so we went down. I didn't make it there. I tried to get into the Canadian Air Force. Two of us drove overnight up to Ottawa to get into the RAF.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't. We got buried there on a holiday.
Oops.
So back we go. So finally I decided I'll wait till they draft me. And so I waited till they draft me.
So you really were determined to go get a piece of this fight.
I was.
So when they did draft you, you didn't hesitate, I'm sure.
No.
And you ended up in the 106th Infantry Division, the Golden Lions?
Eventually.
Yeah? You didn't go directly there?
No, I had a year and a half, almost 2 years, running around in the Army. I went to the 10th Armored Division first.
Uh-huh.
I went to Fort Benning, Georgia. It was a new tank, and I was in the 3rd Cavalry. There, the cadre for that outfit had been in the at Arlington. They did the funerals at Arlington. Huh. They were the 3rd Cavalry.
Uh-huh.
So I did my basic there. Did my maneuvers, and then I had a chance to go to OCS or to ASTP. Well, OCS was 90 days, ASTP was 2 years, so I took ASTP.
That's the Army Specialized Training Program?
Yeah.
So they sent you to a college campus?
Yeah, Auburn in Alabama. I missed going back to Pittsburgh by one guy, and we stood in line. I just went down. This guy went to Carnegie Tech, but I went to Auburn.
Uh-huh.
Spent a semester there. We were taking 23 hours of college credit plus Army. I didn't make it. So I went back. They put me into a pool. In fact, I went back to my 10th Armored Division.
Mm-hmm.
I was home on furlough. A friend of mine says, why don't you go down and join the Air Corps? I was like, yeah, I'm in. He said, no, you can still apply. So I went down and took the test for pilot in the Air Corps. And I ended up with 3 good scores. They had a pilot, navigator, and bombardier.
Mm-hmm.
3 9s. I had 2 9s and an 8. So I'm in, next thing I know, I'm in Miami, Florida, waiting for some other tests, the dexterity tests and visual tests and that. And I passed all them and ended up in Malta, Missouri as a qualified air cadet waiting for assignment for class to start.
Mm-hmm.
And then came the war on June 6th or whatever.
June 6th, 44.
D-Day, rather. You know, and so they needed some people.
They needed troops on the ground.
Yeah, so they took the qualified troops out of a lot of these infantry divisions, 106 being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they left a cadre there, and then they took ASTP and Air Corps on the side. If you had come from the ground troops into the Air Corps, you're going back. The guys that didn't, they stayed. And so that's when June 44, about in there, is when I went to 106.
And so after all of that, trying to join 2 days after Pearl Harbor, trying to go to Canada to get in on the fight, and then bouncing around throughout the states in 1944, you're headed across the ocean to fight the Germans. What was going through your mind as you headed across the Atlantic?
Well, I was seasick. For it was an English ship.
Uh-huh.
The food was lousy, but the crew was pretty sharp. They had food that they would sell you on the side, and you could get some cookies. And I think I ended up eating Oreos and drinking Pepsi-Cola all the way across.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of ex-prisoners of war, and for a POW to say the food was lousy, it must have been really lousy.
It was, because I'd dump it in, and I'd go get some candy bars.
Well, it sounds, if you were seasick the whole way, you were going to dump it eventually anyway.
Yeah, I was short-coded.
So when you got across the pond, you're with the 106th Infantry Division, and you end up in December of 1944 in an area called Schnee Eifel, which is near the Ardennes Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And people that are listening are hearing those buzzwords. They're saying Battle of the Bulge. But at this point, you have no idea what the Battle of the Bulge is.
It hadn't started yet.
Mm-hmm.
We relieved the 2nd Division on the line. There was the Maginot Line that the French had, and the Germans right across had the Siegfried Line.
Right.
And so I was in the anti-tank platoon.
Uh-huh.
And we had a 57-millimeter anti-tank gun that would never knock out a Tiger tank, but that's what we had.
So we anti-tank gun and name only, huh?
Yeah, we ended up relieving the position of an anti-tank gun from the 2nd Army Infantry Division. They had one of the concrete bunkers.
Right.
And there was nothing in it but beds like you see on the ship with an Army and Navy, just
mm-hmm.
poles and wire and so forth. No mattresses, nothing. But it was out of the snow because there was 8-10 inches of snow on the ground. And so we bunked there. We were there for 2 days. We got there about the 14th of
14th of December 1944. Yeah. And I'm sure everybody I've talked to who was in this part of the world at this time is saying that they were told this was a quiet front. There's right. nothing happening here. You have nothing to worry about, right?
Right. They put us up there to get some experience.
Uh-huh.
As an example, for the gun they give us, we had 5 rounds of ammunition for that 57-millimeter gun. Our own personal, we had two clips on our belt for our rifle and one in the rifle. And that's all the ammunition we had. We couldn't beat a Boy Scout troop, you know. but it was supposed to be a quiet zone that let us get adapted to what we were doing and get a little bit of experience before we see the big fight.
So what was the first inkling you had that this was not a quiet zone and that you had company in this neighborhood?
Well, I'll tell you a little story along that line. The sergeant and I were up on out of the bunk. It was just getting dark.
Mm-hmm.
And with those trees, with the forest, they were close together, straight pine trees, and snow on the ground. And if somebody was walking, you could follow them because the snow would blank out where mm-hmm. they were walking. And we were up there and all at once. We looked out and we see 50 yards away, something like that. And I don't know who fired first, whether my sergeant fired or they fired or what. But there was a little short exchange, and then it all quit. So Art couldn't have fired the first round because he didn't fire any. I did. And I said, well, why didn't you fire? And he was a married man with a couple kids. And he says, I thought a guy might have kids at home like I have.
Hmm.
The irony of this is that out of our group, the first guy to get killed was Art. But later on in the time. But he wouldn't shoot, and then he ends up being the one that gets...
He didn't want to deprive some kids of their father.
Yeah.
And his children were deprived of their father.
So the next... Well, then the next morning, on the 16th, daybreak, all hell broke loose. That's when the shells start flying. Mm-hmm. And they just come and come and come. And they did for, 2 days while we... Well, we stayed there 2 nights. On the... We went there. We were there the 16th and 17th, and then the 18th. And then we got orders to move out on the 19th. And we got the truck and the cannon and started and fell in line. There was trucks as far as you could see in a line.
I can only imagine.
It was, by now it's slow. You stop and you sit there and this. Eventually we ended up on this... long, narrow hillside road. It'd be like looking down on the ground, looking up at 168 going to Shaver, with that road along the mountain going up.
Our Central Valley listeners can picture that, sure.
And if you fill that all full of trucks, it was like going to the carnival. These guys were down here with 88s that could hit that thing those up there without any trouble, and we couldn't move. By now we were boxed in.
So you were sitting ducks with the German artillery aimed right at you.
Yeah. So that's when we got orders to surrender.
We have to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we'll get some more details on that early action of the Battle of the Bulge and then what happened after he and some fellow troops were surrendered. Mac McMullen of Fresno, our guest today. We'll be right back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue now with Mac McMullen, 88 years old of Fresno. He was a prisoner of war for the final months of World War II. We haven't got to that part of his story yet. Maybe you've seen his story before. If you have that book, Stories of Service, Valley Veterans, Remember World War II. Great job by Janice Stevens putting all those stories together. And Mac's story is in there. We're getting a few more details out of them today here on Hometown Heroes. And when we left off, we heard about the early stages of the Battle of the Bulge. He was with the 106th Infantry Division in an anti-tank platoon and saw that intense first couple days of action in mid-December of 1944. Now, you took us up to the point, Mac, where your unit was surrendered. But before that, I imagine this was a pretty intense couple days of action with the fire going both ways from the Germans, from the Americans. And was there anything in all your training that had prepared you for what you faced in that forest in December of 44?
No, not really. The maneuvers that we did, you were taught how to shoot the gun and your rifle and fire the cannon. But outside of that, no.
Was it pretty much nonstop firing or only until you ran out of ammo?
Well, we didn't have any ammo, so it was a one-way street for a while, or from behind us with the 155 cannons, they could fire over us to the Germans, but mostly it was the Germans firing at us as we tried to get our way out of there.
So you were covering your ears and trying to find a safe spot?
In the truck.
In the truck. How close did shells come to you?
Oh, not really that close. 50 yards, something like that, because they had a whole line. They started picking them off at that time. So then you're blocked in. You can't get out.
So you're stuck.
Yeah.
You got nowhere to go, and you're seeing your fellow soldiers and their positions hit by German artillery. Mm-hmm. What is that duty? I mean, how do you have hope in a situation like that?
You don't think. You just do.
I've heard that said before. And you took us up to the point where you got word that your unit had been surrendered.
Right.
Is that something that was a relief to you, or did it upset you?
No, it was a disappointment.
Yeah.
Because we weren't more or less trained, but they surrendered a whole column.
Thousands of soldiers.
Thousands, and also we were trained to destroy our equipment if we could, try and do something with the truck or the cannon, so
it wouldn't be used against you.
Yeah.
So did you do anything like that?
Well, we tried to, and one of the officers told us to stop it. That was a disappointment. By why, I don't know. We did, but by that time, we'd taken care of ours, but a lot of them hadn't. So that they the rest of it was just confusion, because you couldn't go anywhere or do anything. But just maybe a little prayer here and there wouldn't help or wouldn't do any.
Well, I noted that when I read your story in the book that Janice put together, Stories of Service, you made mention of that, not having been a very religious person, but doing a whole lot of praying then.
That was a later on.
Later on, you did a whole lot of praying.
Well, it was that night.
Uh-huh.
So we were captured late in the evening and marched down the hill. And they got a little town called Belief, B-E-L-I-E-F or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I congregated us there, put us in column, and so many abreast, and started down there. Didn't stay abreast very long. It was just mass. At least see on the movies, confusion.
And was there talk among your ranks of guys trying to go out on their own, make a break for it, avoid capture and captivity?
Not at that point. We weren't sure. We didn't know what we were doing. We were just surrounded. That's the night I got my feet wet. I got both feet wet, and I didn't have combat boots because they didn't have my size. So I got the regular shoe, and I tried to go through a little stream where you jump across. I got both feet wet and got them frozen. Mm-hmm. And later on, as things went on, because we walked that particular time, we walked from the middle of that afternoon, all that night, all the next day, and then before we stopped. And by the time we got there, my feet were frozen. And I was at the point where I couldn't make it anymore. And this is when I went to church and Sunday school and all that, but I was one of these guys that prayed for a bicycle or something like that. And I was holding back, saving that, I guess. I didn't know it. But I prayed that just give me one more half mile. Just give me one more half mile. And then I got to where I was. I was getting ready to drop out. And somebody I don't know, never saw him before. I've never seen him since. He was a big guy. He grabbed me by put on his shoulder or arm, and he helped me. And with him and some other help, I got there through the night and the next day. But that was tough because I couldn't. I was ready to drop out. I just couldn't go anymore.
And for our listeners, tell us what that would have meant if you would have dropped out. You would have been left for dead, or maybe
they might shoot me or to make sure I wasn't playing games with them, and so that they didn't. No, they did not have frozen. My feet were already frozen. I couldn't go anywhere.
You know? So you thought that was it?
Yep, that was as close as I've ever come.
And a desperate prayer was answered, and a big, strapping fellow American who, and who knows who he was, huh?
I don't know. Never saw him. It was in the middle of the night. And I didn't ask him. He saw me stumbling and heading for the edge of the column and grabbed me and says, "Hang in there." And we, the two of us, stumbled along. You've seen it in the movies, and that's the way it is.
And I've had so many prisoners of war repeat to me the POW motto of "We help those who can't help themselves." And there was someone who helped you when you couldn't help yourself. How many times over the years have you thought back to that when someone needed help from you?
I've been there.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell it's still powerful for you, and I certainly understand why. So you made it through that night.
We wept all that night, and then the next day, and then they finally let us start, give us a rest. And then some of us were in a schoolhouse, some of us were in a church, a barn, whatever, because there wasn't any facilities, it was just where you could flop.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent that night there. And then the next day, we were in a little town called Gerolstein, Gerolstein, something like that. And mm-hmm. they loaded us on boxcars at that time.
And this is the famous 40 and 8?
Mm-hmm.
40 people or 8 horses, but I'm sure they stuck a lot more than 40 in there.
60.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't, you sat down with your knees up, and then the guy got behind you and his back to yours were the same. And if you got into that position, everybody got in that position, you could all sit down at one time. Otherwise, you couldn't.
And you probably needed that for some body heat, too, right?
The heat came from the manure that was in the boxcar. There was about 8-10 inches of manure in the boxcar. And us city boys didn't know how many BTUs there were on a pound of horse manure. but it was because the next day, couple guys, when they would let us out to relieve ourselves, and,
sure.
and there was no water, so we'd be eating some snow, and a couple of them asked if they could shovel this stuff out, the manure out. Well, man, when that part where the car, where these jokers got rid of the manure, was frozen just like the...
Never thought you'd be wishing for horse manure,
no,
huh?
No.
And this sounds like a miserable existence. I mean, certainly the uncertainty could eat you alive, if not the freezing temperatures and just the agony of really not having any sustenance.
We hadn't eaten. When we got captured, we hadn't eaten for 2 days. They just had to bring the chow up to us because when we were by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Jeep didn't get there for 2 days before we were captured. Mm-hmm. So we still didn't have anything to eat until, well, I guess it would be the second day. They give us a loaf of bread for 5 guys, one of their brown breads that we make out of
sawdust. Tree flour.
Yeah.
And I understand that quite a few fights came out of those loaves of bread. Guys would really want to make sure that they got as big of a piece as the guy next to them.
Did you read my story?
Every POW has that story. A, the bread was so hard you needed a table saw to cut it, and B, you wanted to make sure everybody got their fair piece.
Well, one time we were doing, as you speak, this was later on when we were in a camp,
mm-hmm.
and they give us the bread, and we take turns cutting it, and then and you cut it, and you got what was left. And I got an argument with a guy over this, which of these two slices of bread was which. And there was the difference wouldn't make a damn bit of difference to anybody at any time. And I was really upset, got in a big argument with him.
Mm-hmm.
I got so upset that I just said, I'll cut the bread every day. From then on, I cut the bread. I took the it just wasn't worth.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't that kind of guy, and when I realized what I'd done, arguing with him over what I argued with him, I was upset with myself,
mm-hmm.
and so I said, "The hell with it."
I don't blame you. I know we've got a lot of ground to cover with your story because it has so many twists and turns, and I think right now we better take another break, but we'll come back and pick it up in captivity with Mac McMullen, 88 years old of Fresno, a former prisoner of war, and I'm sure his story is touching you the way it's hitting home for me. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a fascinating discussion this week with Mac McMullen, a former prisoner of war who now lives in Fresno. He's been here for more than 40 years, and he will be there next Saturday at the VA Hospital Central California. That is on Clinton Avenue in Fresno at 10 a.m. It's the dedication ceremony for the American Ex-Prisoner of War Monument, honoring those who gave up so much of their lives in captivity of enemy forces during World War II and other conflicts. So that's next Saturday, April 10th, 10 in the morning at the VA Hospital, Central California. You'll run into some other people that you've probably heard on this show from time to time. Let's continue with Mac's story. He told us about being on one of those 40 and 8 boxcars, an infamous thing that so many prisoners of war from the European theater can reminisce about, and it's not all pleasant memories, and they can commiserate, maybe is a better choice of words. And at some point, you finally got to a destination. Was that a relief to get off those boxcars?
Well, in between there, we were in the rail yards when they bombed us at Limburg. And that's where I lost my sergeant. It was a rail yard like you have here in Fresno. And the English and the Americans both bombed it that night.
And so your trains were stopped on the tracks, and you're just
sitting ducks
for American and British bombers who have no idea what's in those trains.
And there was a prisoner of war camp for officers on the hill. They hit it a couple of times. I didn't know that was up there. It killed about 70 of the officers.
What was that experience? I'm sure it was incredibly loud and had to be scary.
Well, it sure was. You're just run around the circle. It's interesting. You don't stand still. You just run, but you don't know where you're running. Well, first of all, we were locked in. And at each end of these cars, there was a little window with barbed wire on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody in our group was able to tear the barbed wire out. And then somehow we knocked a board off so that we could get a guy out to unlock our car. And then you'd go along and somebody would unlock the one in front of you or behind you.
Because the Germans had cleared out because they didn't want to get hit.
They were gone. They were gone. that was an interesting one because you're there and they're dropping. I have pictures of that with the potholes all around the cars all up in the air, broken up and so forth. When it was over with, they grounded us all up. A couple of guys maybe tried to get away then, but they didn't get very far. And, But that's where I lost my sergeant. He was going along helping people open doors for cars so they could get out.
And a bomb hit?
He was killed.
So. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I hear maybe a little element in you saying that of that could have been you.
Yeah. It was just pot luck.
And I'm sure that's one of countless moments throughout the rest of your captivity that was like that. So after you survived the shelling by American and British forces, Allied forces, of your motionless rail cars, they got you moving again?
Yeah, they moved us to Stalag 4B. And this is the first time they interrogated us, if you want to call it that. They lined us all up, took our pictures, and there's where they segregated us. Officers didn't work, non-coms didn't work, but privates worked.
Uh-huh.
So when you went through, I didn't have any stripes on my shirt, but I'd been a sergeant once. I had to give it up to go to ASTP. So I had my paybook where it had sergeant in it. So when he asked me what I was, I told him I was a sergeant. And he says, well, where's your stripes? And I took them off. So I showed him the paybook. So I got into the line with the non-coms where I didn't have to work. And most of my guys ended up on the other line going to coal mines or farms or something like that. But you'd go through and then he'd ask you your name and they took your picture. And I have my picture that was somebody got it later on when the Russians liberated another camp. And
they grabbed all those files?
And passed them out and I still got the picture.
I've seen it. It's in that book, Stories of Service, Valley Veterans Remember World War II. Maybe I'll post an image of it on our website as well. So you become, as some people have put it, a guest of the Gestapo, a prisoner of war.
Yeah.
And what was that existence like? What was the most challenging aspect of it?
Just not knowing day to day what was going to happen. Like at this camp, then they put us in, give us our first shower and de-louse us. They de-louse you with kerosene. They have a can of, you stand there spread-eagled naked, and they swat behind your arms and in the crotch to go kill the lice.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it burns a little bit.
No, thank you.
But then they put us in there. There was a English people and the Canadians that had been there for a while, years. Mm. They were orderly and so forth. And so one of them would be your, they call him your mucker. That's an English phrase for my buddy, you know. And so he looked after you. Well, and then they fed us some. We all got sick because he ate too much. Because
you hadn't eaten for all that trip.
Yes. Just here and there. We had, I think in a trip we had some bread once and maybe some cheese once. But now we're making hogs out of ourselves, and we all got sick and got diarrhea, which didn't help the situation.
But maybe you learned your lesson there, so you didn't repeat your mistake after you got out?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure the general meals and diet in your prisoner of war camp wasn't exactly luxurious.
No. It was usually soup, and they give you coffee or tea, and you use that to shave with eventually, because it wasn't worth drinking, but it was hot water. So that's where we got the hot water to shave with. It was what they give us in the morning, and maybe a potato, something like that. They had Red Cross parcels at times, but with moving around like they had, and having so many, I maybe got 10 Red Cross parcels in the whole time I was there. And they had all goodies.
For a lot of prisoners of war, they were taken to a destination at this camp or that camp, and they stayed there until they were liberated, and that was it. But for you, your story was a little different.
Yeah, I was there for, I forget how long, they put me on the boxcars again, and for three or four days, it was a four-day trip to Stalag 3B. It's on the Oder River, it's between, almost in Poland. We stayed there for, maybe 2 weeks, and then 2 o'clock in the morning, they woke us up and said, get your stuff, you're moving out. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, they routed us out of. We grabbed a blanket if we could and whatever. That's all we had anyway, basically. And maybe a pot, a kettle to eat out of or you had. And started us down the road. And this was an eight-day walk in the snow and so forth, cold.
And you didn't know how long it was going to be or where your destination was?
Had no idea.
So, again, you're just walking with no end in sight?
Mm-hmm.
No feeling in your feet, probably?
No. We passed some Jewish prisoners in their pajamas. And that's all, basically, that was all they had on, wooden shoes. And they were coming the opposite direction that we were. And they would take turns being in the back. Because the guy in the back had a limb or he or whip
a switch or something.
Switch or something. He keep just hitting the guy. So they take turns being the back guy.
They would take turns to receive that punishment, the flogging in the back.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been hard to see too.
And well, they were just barely got by us, and there was a rifle shot. They shot one of them while we were going by him. I don't know what he did, but they didn't like it.
At that point, did you have any idea of how the Jews had been annihilated there?
No, didn't know anything about it.
But I'm sure after the war, once you read about it, you said, oh, man, you look back.
Yeah, we just walked the rest of this to, it was over 100 miles, all told in 8 days. Sleep at night anywhere in a barn and here or there. We were in a barnyard one time. This is a good size farm. They use the glass eggs for the chickens to help them may want to lay eggs.
Right.
Well, before we moved out in the morning, some clown had taken one of those out of the nest or whatever they call it. He didn't know it, what it was. He thought it was an egg. And the farmer, boy, they lined us all up and were going to shoot us if we didn't. Boy, and the egg came out in a hurry about that time.
He didn't know how.
He didn't know what he was. He was a city guy like me.
The things you learn at wartime.
Yeah.
And I imagine, I can't imagine what that must have felt like to be on that march. It sounds like an absolute nightmare. And I'm curious to know what it was that kept you going. And what it felt like when you finally did reach a destination?
Well, you just kept going because you had to keep going. what are you going to do, you know, and make the best of it.
Just the will to survive?
Yep, yep. And it's there. And you just picked one foot up, put it in front of the other. And it was so damn numb and dumb, and you just didn't know. Didn't have time to worry.
Your brain was probably pretty frozen, too.
Yeah, that was frostbitten.
Well, I know we're getting closer and closer to the end of the war, closer to your being able to taste freedom again. So we'll take a break, and when we come back, you can tell us about that. Mac McMullen, former prisoner of war, is our guest today. We'll hear the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes returns after this on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, this program goes by too quickly, so I want to get right back to the story of Mac McMullen of Fresno. You'll see him and other ex-prisoners of war next Saturday at the VA Hospital Central California, 10 a.m. at the hospital will be that dedication of the American ex-POW monument. I invite you to go out there. I wish I could be there. I'm going to be in Hawaii calling a baseball game, but next Saturday at the VA Medical Center, Central California. Let's continue with Mac McMullen. We left off. He was marching and marching and marching with no feeling in his feet, freezing temperatures outside, nowhere comfortable to lay his head. And finally, he'd been to Stalag 12A, Stalag 4B, Stalag 3B, and eventually you end up at Stalag 3A. And the conditions there were a little more cramped than the previous camps?
Well, they were cramped to where there was no room, and they put up seven carnival tents and put 400 of us in each one of those tents for a total of 2,800 people. Ooh. And we had two water faucets for the 2,800 people and one big latrine for 2,800 people. And
so otherwise, in other words, you were basically living like cattle.
Right. Mm-hmm. We slept on straw on the ground. So you put 400 in those tents and you have to have a small space that you're in and leave a small space for people to get out if they want to go out for water or go to relieve themselves. When the weather got better, the favorite sport was to sit in the outside, watch the American bombers go over and pick lice off yourself.
Something tells me you don't do that anymore these
days.
It's amazing how things change. And obviously, you're here talking to me, so you survived this camp just like you did the three previous camps. If you hadn't survived all of this, there are four children and three grandchildren who never would have been born because you met your wife in college at West Virginia Wesleyan after you came back. You've been married for more than 60 years. And I'm sure that's something you can use against them from time to time, remind them they wouldn't be here. But how are you here? How did you survive getting from there to being a free man again?
Well, The Russians took over the camp as the war got to a close. And we found that they had the fence and then they had a warning fence. They would shoot you if you went over the warning fence. Well, the Russians got in the tower. We weren't sure what they were going to do or anything. Eventually, some guy went over the warning wire and didn't get shot. We found we could go over that. The next thing you know,
that guy had some cojones, didn't he?
Yeah. Another runner, maybe him, cut the regular barbed wire fence and took off, and they didn't shoot him. So we found out we could get out of there if we wanted to. So for 2 days, another fellow and I went to town, and we traded with the people in town. We traded cigarettes for bread and anything, meat and anything we could, and bring it back. And then we'd sell it to the other guys by a raised price. We bought it for one ciggy. We might sell it for 5 or 10 ciggies. Next thing you know, we have a whole satchel. It was a gas mask carrier. We had it full of cigarettes, each of it.
Pretty rich man.
Yeah, we had that lucky bucks. So we decided, we were sitting there not knowing. We heard that they may take us to Odessa. Well, Odessa's going the wrong way. That's Russia. So we'll be going back that way. So Bill and I decided we'd take off, and we took off, and we got down the road about 10 miles, and the Russians picked us up and brought us back. So the next day, we decided to go again, and we got out on the road, and there was a Russian truck come along, or it was an American truck with a Russian driving it, and we flagged him down, and Bill could talk. He was Polish, and he could talk a little bit to. We told him what we wanted to ride, so we give him some cigarettes and get up on top of his truck where the canvas between the bows on the top. And he rode us right straight past the checkpoint and in fact took us to his motor pool where we spent the night with him. The next day we decided to take off, and I had a little American flag I made out of a handkerchief and some lipstick and a pencil. And
what were you doing with lipstick?
Oh, I got it. I bought it with
cigarettes.
Yeah, I bought it with ciggies. So we decided to go in. We were heading for Wittenberg, where the river was. And we hadn't gone too far, and two guys come by on bicycles. So we stopped them and took their bicycles away from them. It was a big argument, but Bill explained to them that we're taking the bikes whether they liked it or not. So there's. We drove off into town. We got into town and ran into two French couples that had been slave labor and were trying to get back to France. And we talked to them. They spoke English, and we talked to them. So they asked us to sign. They had pictures of themselves, and they asked if we'd write something nice on there for them so they could show it to the GIs when they. Yeah. So we wrote our that they had befriended us, and we appreciated they'd give them any help, and then signed our name to it. And,
mm-hmm.
and I say the first GI probably shot him, but that's okay.
I hope not.
I hope not.
And who knows? Maybe those pictures are still floating around somewhere.
It could be. So we went out. We had the Siggies. Siggies were universal.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew where we could get some bread, and we got some. Potatoes, and we got some, I don't know what all, but we got some wine and some beer. And so six of us had a party that night. And then we got up the next day and took off again to get going down to the river. We rode our bikes. And so we got to Wittenberg, and we happened to see down at the end of the street there was a GI Jeep. Wittenberg was still under Russian control. Mm-hmm. It was on the river. We saw this Jeep, and we took off, pedaling like hell. And we got down there, and the colonel, American colonel, had come over to talk to the Russian colonel. Was the reason they were there.
Mm-hmm.
So when he got out of his meeting, we all got in the Jeep, and they took us back to the MP quarters back on the other side of the river. So we were home. It was all over with then.
And you had mentioned the flag that you made, and I cut you off about the lipstick, but you had fashioned this makeshift flag and then attached it to your sleeve?
Yeah.
Just to identify yourself as American.
Well, but I had a POW or PW written all over my uniform and with the American flag on it.
You didn't want there to be any question.
Oh, no questions.
Who you were. So, what did that feel like when you got in that Jeep and took a ride? And I imagine you have to think that you are finally free and finally safe again.
Well, for us, the war was over, and I thought that's a mistake I made, but because it wasn't particularly over, but it was. We thought it was, and we were happy to get back. And these guys, we had anything we wanted to eat. We sat in. I wanted a jar of peanut butter, a quart of milk, and some fresh bread. I could have had steak, but I'm a peanut butter and sandwich. That's what, after all that, the first thing I wanted to eat was a peanut butter sandwich with a glass of milk.
Something tells me you still enjoy peanut butter and a glass of milk.
Oh, I do.
And you said that the war wasn't quite over. What happened from there?
Well, we went back home and we got 60 days at home.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back for reassignment. I was 5 points short of getting out. They had a point system. I was on my way. They were going to send me to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I ended up, while we were there, the Japanese war ended.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of August. So I was sent to Washington, D.C., to Fort Belvoir first for another reassignment. And then I went to Walter Reed Hospital. I was the sergeant of the guard at Walter Reed Hospital. Put the flag up and down every day and chase guys that are drunk and bring them home.
And you probably saw a lot of wounded soldiers there, too.
Yeah, well, see, we had the jail we had. There was two jails. One was for the people who worked or were stationed at Walter Reed, and the other was for the patients that were there. Mm-hmm. And I had one interesting one. I had to go out, and they got a call. Somebody stole Maryland State Trooper's car and his uniform and all this, and they knew where he was, and I went out. They got him. I went out to get him. And he was an amputee because Walter Reed was where the amputees came.
And still is.
Yeah. And I brought him back, and I didn't put him in jail. I put him up in the ward where he was from. About in the morning when my 12-hour shift was over, I was called into the captain. And he says, "How'd it go last night?" And I says, "Well, not too bad." He says, "Anything out of the ordinary?" I says, "Oh, nothing." He says, then he brings this guy up. So they court-martialed this guy. And I had to testify against him because I was told if I didn't tell what happened and the way it happened and what I that they were he was going to jail. And if I didn't tell a story right, I was going with him.
Well, that's good enough motivation.
Yeah.
One question about that, your time at Walter Reed. Is it fair to say that when, and we talked about your sergeant getting hit at the rail yard over in Europe, is it fair to say, too, that when you were at Walter Reed and you saw these amputees and guys who came home not the same physically as they went over, that it was another opportunity for you to be thankful and to see what could have been?
Yeah. And they were great guys.
Well, Mac, we're short on time here, and I'm sure everyone at home has really appreciated hearing your story and blown away by all the things that you had to endure and survive. Is there anything that you want to pass on, anything that you learned from all these experiences or anything that you're most thankful for that you want to share with our audience?
There's three things that I come back with. One, I wanted to get a college education. Don't make a mistake, you'll pay for it. And the last one was to, if you believe in something, stick with it and fight it all the way through. That's the three things I can make.
And so you've done that ever since?
I've tried.
Well, Mac, thank you so much for serving our country. And I know we probably didn't even get to all of your story today, but it's clear how much you love your country and how much you were willing to pay a price for our freedom. So thank you very much, and thanks for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you.
That's Mac McMullen. Thanks for listening today on News Talk 580 KMJ.